B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, March 15th, 2017. Tomorrow's podcast may be late or it may not happen. I've got some conflicts on my schedule and we'll just have to see how it all plays out. But Friday, as usual, I'll be on live video on Facebook, 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 o'clock Eastern Time, and I hope you can check it out. On my way home last night, I heard, I got an alert on my phone that Rachel Maddow had somehow acquired Donald Trump tax returns. There was a lot of hype coming out of MSDNC. And I got home, and of course, here, the Maddow show clears at 6 p.m. And usually I watch it later in the evening. But I flipped it on right away. And it was so frustrating, because in typical Maddow style, she buried the lead. That's an old newspaper term for people who write an article where the most important part is buried. And so she said, hey, we got Trump tax returns. She started waving them around. But 20 minutes later, we still hadn't seen them. And they had already been leaked to other media by the White House. So Rachel Maddow stepped on her own scoop. She bungled an exclusive. And it wasn't just in terms of timing. I've been watching Rachel Maddow since she started on MSNBC after she left Air America. And I've been cheering for her up until really the last year or so. And she tilted deeply in favor of Hillary Clinton while maintaining the veneer of impartiality. She had Bernie Sanders on many occasions. But she really dirtied herself in carrying water for the establishment Democrats and the overlords at NBC, who maintain this channel to essentially provide Democratic propaganda. And her show is a magazine show. It doesn't cover all the stories in the news during a day. If you relied on her solely, you'd know very little about what's going on. You'd be rich in Republican opposition research. That's what her show was about last year. So I was pleased to see that David K. Johnston, a man I've known for over 15 years, Pulitzer Prize winner from the New York Times, now an independent journalist, he teaches journalism. He's been a guest on this program many times. Just put his name in the search window at peterbcollins.com, and you'll hear my interview with him about Donald Trump from last summer. Now, David K. Johnston did not oversell the goods that he delivered. And he didn't appear to be uncomfortable or squirming. But when he was given a chance to talk by the Motormouth host, he really took things in a slightly different direction. And as noted by Willa Paskin, who is the TV critic over at Slate, she says, Rachel Maddow, you played yourself and us too. And Willa describes how, in excruciating detail with heavy repetition, in the first segment of the program, Rachel Maddow recapped Trump's refusal to release his taxes. That's germane. She recapped the history of presidents releasing or not releasing their taxes, took us back to Nixon. That was germane. And then she shifted. And she did a recap of what I call her serialized Russian spy thriller. And she, of course, has gone off the deep end, embracing as fact the unproven assertions that came out of the Clinton campaign and the intelligence community, embraced by President Obama, that Russia hacked the DNC and ultimately tilted our election to Trump. And if you are a regular listener, you know that I'm skeptical of this, because we've seen no proof. And if proof is provided, I will accept the reality, the verification, when and if it surfaces. But continuing here with the critique from Willa Paskin at Slate, she said, well, then Maddow launched into a long hypothetical about a particular Russian oligarch's possible relationship to Trump that touched on Florida real estate, Deutsche Bank, and Preet Bharara. the Manhattan U.S. attorney who was fired after he refused to resign. And she created the speculation that the tax return that she was about to unveil was going to clear up many of these questions. But the payoff was deeply disappointing. It was just the summary pages of Trump's tax return, of his 1040. And there, while you see the amounts, and we'll get into them in a moment, that he earned in 2005, the taxes he paid, the deductions that he took, we don't know where his income came from. We don't know where the write-offs all came from. So without the full return, this is a tease. And it's possible that David K. Johnston was played. And he, of course, is a journalist. He got this information. He has the right to publish it. It's not illegal or criminal act, as the White House has falsely suggested. But the way his work was framed by Rachel Maddow was deeply disappointing to me, and it undermined the impact of the revelation. Now, Johnston himself was honest. And he was the first to say, maybe Donald Trump leaked this himself or told somebody to leak it to me. We've seen that the envelope was postmarked in Westchester County in New York, the rich suburbs of the city, where Trump owns a golf course. And it was mailed to David K. Johnston's home in Rochester. And Johnston told me in the interview last summer how he got a call from Trump at home. And Trump was basically putting him on notice that he would sue Johnston if Johnston's forthcoming book had even a shred of inaccuracy in it. That lawsuit has not occurred. And so it was a bizarre effort. And Rachel Maddow is on top of the ratings right now. MSNBC is getting the best ratings it has, I think, in its history. I don't know exactly how she is comparing ratings-wise with Bill O'Reilly at this moment. But what the Slate critic Willa Paskin notes is that Maddow promised to pull a sordid revelation out of a hat and instead plucked out Trump's credibility. And the catnip here, the trap that was laid, is that the 2005 summary of his tax returns that was leaked to David K. Johnston shows that Trump actually made money that year and paid taxes. He paid $38 million on $150 million in income. Now, the income was reduced by over $100 million in write-offs that could have been the final installment in the $900 million loss that he reported back in 1995 and was able to carry forward until he ran out of it. So, this release raises more questions. Many of them are deeply legitimate. We deserve to know the answers, and only full disclosure will provide them. And the final lament from Willa Paskin here is to Rachel Maddow. Don't tell us you have news. Just tell us the news. I think that's good advice for anybody who sits in front of a camera or behind a microphone. Yours truly included. So let's get to the numbers here. What we learned is that Trump did have an income in 2005. And he did pay taxes. And he's going to try to use this to say, look, you don't want to look at the rest of my tax return. See, I paid taxes. I made money. I'm rich. But one of the questions that is begged here is if you add it up, take away the $100 million write-off, he was reporting gross income of about $250 million. And he claims to be worth $10 billion. Now, that's a pretty paltry return on what is claimed to be a huge pile of wealth. And I'm not expert enough to run the numbers here, but I believe I have listeners and subscribers who know how to calculate things like that. And if you'd like to help me out, feel free, send me an email and let me know what the actual rate of return of $250 million against $10 billion would pencil out to be. So the details that we learned, for example, Trump made $67 million in real estate royalties, $42 million in business income, $32 million in capital gains, $9 million in taxable interest, and a paltry salary of just under $1 million, $998,599. So the total income there was $153 million. And then the, that's interesting. So I have to take back what I said. The gross income was about $153, not $250. So again, his rate of return on assets of claimed at $10 billion looks pretty weak there. And 2005 was not overall a bad year for investors or profiteers. So we'll see what the ultimate impact of this is. And I continue to have very high respect for David K. Johnston. He's fielding a lot of big league interviews right now. He was on ABC and NBC this morning. And when it dies down, I'll catch up with David and get him to tell us more about this episode. And he got the information late yesterday, or I guess he was in Florida. His daughter sent him a copy of the documents that had arrived in the mail. And he quickly negotiated with MSNBC. He said he would have preferred to go on with Lawrence O'Donnell because he knows more about taxes. But Rachel is the queen bee over at MSDNC. The wars continue unabated. 31 people killed in Damascus today from a suicide bombing. And Trump, who told us he had a secret plan to end that war in Syria and vanquish the Islamic State, well, he hasn't told us the plan, or even that he is, to, you know, enacting a plan. But the Pentagon has drawn up plans to double the number of American troops in Syria to about 2,000, inserting 1,000 more from the 82nd Airborne and the 24th Marine Expeditionary Unit. Oh, we're told they're advisors. They're not going to be shooting at people. They're going to be telling people to shoot at people. And that may be true, but you know, once one of our people gets killed, it changes the chemistry and dimension of these conflicts in ways that you cannot recover from. And so, on one hand, I say this could be sensible, because the idea that we want to eliminate the Islamic State from Raqqa, and that we're going to rely on the Free Syrian Army and the YPG Kurdish fighters, if you really want to get the job done, you'd want to put overwhelming force in there. And even, you know, 1,000, 2,000 American troops does not amount to overwhelming force. We're told that there are less than 5,000 Islamic State fighters holed up in Raqqa. And I want to be clear here. I'm talking military strategy in a hypothetical way. I do not support the insertion of a single additional American military member in the theater in Syria. But of course, nobody's listening to me. Meanwhile, in the whatever war, Afghan officials are confirming that the death toll from the hospital attack a week ago has exceeded 50 people, and 24 were arrested in connection with that event. And there's an interesting analytical piece at The Intercept today from a writer named Mehdi Hassan. I think he's a recent addition to The Intercept reporting team. And he analyzes the situation, saying that we should be prepared for the Trump surge. After all, when Obama took office, he added 30,000 troops. Then he added another 30,000 troops. For about 18 months, there were 100,000 American armed military fighters in Afghanistan. And we've lost 2,400 Americans in Afghanistan and spent $1 trillion so far. 15 years. And what do we have to show for it? Well, the generals tell Congress that it's a stalemate. But we've lost significant territory and influence in Afghanistan. And Hassan takes issue with the idea that it's a stalemate and notes that if the mission is to support a stable, democratic Afghan government, well, it's been so corrupt there. Mohammad Karzai is no longer in charge, but he and his brothers all got rich on the American occupation. Are we protecting the population? Well, civilian casualties reached their highest level last year since the UN started keeping track in 2009. Are we reducing drug trafficking? No. Afghanistan continues to supply 90% of the world's opium. Are we preventing the spread of the Islamic State? Not so far. Are we defeating the Taliban? You check the scoreboard and let me know. And this is hypocritical because Hassan here quotes Karzai, who became extremely wealthy by extorting money from the Americans and accepting bribes while he was running the country. And he has now shifted from being an enthusiastic supporter of the U.S. intervention to an outspoken critic. And he said before the Trump administration approves a surge, Karzai wants him to explain to the Afghan people why, after more than 15 years, with so much blood and treasure spent, so much loss of life, the country is not secure. Well, Karzai, you've been part of the problem. No question about it. Nevertheless, the question deserves an answer. We are learning from the Justice Department that they have unsealed an indictment, 47 criminal charges against 4 Russians. 2 are members described as intelligence agents, presumably the FSB. And they are charged with directing the sweeping criminal conspiracy that broke into 500 million Yahoo email accounts in 2014. Now, the New York Times says that these 2 Russian agents were supposed to help Americans hunt for hackers, but instead they flipped to the other side, and the claim is that the Russian government then used the data that they obtained to focus on foreign officials, business executives, journalists. Federal prosecutors say that. And the targets included financial executives, executives at cloud computing companies, an airline official, a casino regulator in Nevada. And this is just a question, speculative on my part, but I wonder if this hack was the source of the disclosure of the guys who had signed up on the cheater site called Ashley Madison, where there were apparently 35 million men and about 10 women. Anyway, this is a break in the hacking case, and it's interesting because a friend of mine who's fairly well-informed called to invite me out for a drink later today, and he said, hey, did you hear the good news from Washington? They found the Russian hackers. I said, Jim, this is about Yahoo. It's not about the DNC. And he said, well, let's have a drink and talk about it. So 2 of the agents of the FSB are Dmitry Dukachev and Igor Sustin. The other 2 defendants are a guy named Bilan, a Russian national, and Karim Baratov, a 22-year-old Canadian and Kazakh national who lives in Canada. He was picked up in Canada on Tuesday. So we'll see where all this goes. There could be substance behind it, or this could just be more photo opportunity and PR coming from the new Trump administration. Meanwhile, BuzzFeed has a report based on an unnamed source that Mike Flynn, who was briefly the national security advisor to Trump, 24 days, that he was in fact being investigated by the FBI even before the information surfaced about his phone call with the Russian ambassador. And that information that surfaced, a transcript of the phone call, we still don't know where that came from, and we'll deal with that again in just a moment here. But the unnamed source brought up the Flynn investigation. The official mentioned that the FBI was investigating Flynn, not clear if it was a counterintelligence investigation, and that there was one already up and running in December indicates there was concern among the intelligence community about Flynn's loyalties before his phone calls with Kislyak. After the nature of those calls was revealed by the Washington Post, Flynn quickly left the White House, and then we learned that he was being paid $500,000 by a Turkish lobbying firm. While he was on the payroll on the Trump campaign, we don't know if that continued after he went on the government payroll, but that is a very interesting development. Now, meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, there's chaos. The Republicans are pointing fingers at each other, and specifically related to FBI investigations of Mike Flynn or any other member of the Trump campaign, Lindsey Graham is worked up into a lather. And he's saying, look, I need the FBI to confirm if they've got a criminal investigation because it could affect how we conduct our investigations here on Capitol Hill. Graham says, I want to get to the bottom of it. The FBI would know if a warrant was issued. This relates to the FISA court and whether warrants were used to do any kind of surveillance of the Trump campaign. And they like to, you know, focus specifically on Trump Tower. But that's a kind of meaningless distraction about the location of where any kind of surveillance or wiretaps might have taken place. And there's a real catch-22 because Lindsey Graham and Sheldon Whitehouse are also, and Chuck Grassley has joined the fray here. They're saying that they will not confirm the number two at the Justice Department, Rosenstein, who is a U.S. attorney in Maryland, I believe. They will not proceed with his confirmation until they get answers about these questions. Well, Rosenstein is the guy who is supposed to be the point man to investigate these issues if he is confirmed, because his boss, Jeff Sessions, was forced to recuse himself. Now, this disarray among the Republicans is accentuated by more statements from Devin Nunes, the California Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee. And he's the one who, at the urging of the Trump White House, went public a week or two ago and said, hey, I've seen nothing about this, any evidence that shows that there were phone calls between the Trump campaign and Russian officials. Now, we are supposed to believe Nunes because he gets to see the secret intelligence and we don't. Now, he is hinting in a different direction. He says, related to the claim by Trump that Obama ordered wiretaps of his phones during the campaign last year, Nunes says, we don't have any evidence that took place. In fact, I don't believe in the last week of time, people we've talked to, I don't think there was an actual tap of Trump Tower. Now, this is circular bullshit. And at some point, they've got to come clean. They've got to show us evidence and proof. And they're getting more and more caught up in the stories and in all of the levels of secrecy. It's just a huge mess. And that's not the only form of chaos in Washington. The Republicans are pointing fingers at each other about the efforts to so-called repeal and replace Obamacare. And you've got the conservatives, the ultra-conservatives, and the people who are so far to the right that they fall off the charts. And they're arguing with each other. Some conservatives say, hey, you got to take care of the poor people. You're trimming too much from Medicaid, and my district will probably not reelect me if we pass this bill. Then you have the people who are kind of, you know, not extreme extremists. They're just extreme. And they say, well, this isn't really a repeal of Obamacare, so I can't support it. And then on the far, far right, there are the people who say, well, you know, this does not consign enough people to sickness, poverty, and death. We need to completely eviscerate Obamacare or you won't get my vote. And so the only thing we know so far is that tax cuts for the ultra rich are a centerpiece not only partially enacted through the repeal and replacement process the Republicans have proposed, but because the repeal of Obamacare allows them to forecast $337 billion in deficit reduction over the next 10 years. And that, in turn, enables them to cut taxes for the wealthy even more than we already have. And I remember Dick Cheney, back in about 2001, he was lecturing a fellow Republican who he took out and fired because that Republican opposed the proposed Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. And Cheney just told him, he said, look, don't give me this deficit reduction mantra and all that stuff. He said, it's our turn. And we're going to cut taxes. We don't care what it does to the deficit. We only talk about the deficit when the Democrats are in power. So we'll continue to watch this and see where it all unravels to. Every day, I like to take a minute to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Tim McKay, the incredible actor Joey Perillo, Wendy Gebauer, and yesterday I mentioned her, but I'll mention her again. Lydia Dolan just signed up for a new annual subscription. I'm grateful to each and every one of you. I need more people to support my work, so someday this might be the way I make a living. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on Menu, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page where you get to choose $5, $10, $20 a month or our $50 annual subscription. As of right now, and as I'm speaking to you, it is 2:32 Pacific time. I have not seen any news of a federal judge putting a hold on the Trump travel ban via the royal decree or executive order, whichever you prefer, the revised one, that is scheduled to go into effect at midnight tonight. There's a judge in Maryland considering a request by refugee organizations. There is a court in Hawaii that has hearings underway right now. And at the same time, we have hearings in the courtroom of Judge James Robart in Seattle. He is the judge who issued the original hold on the original Trump travel ban. And lots of arguments are being heard by these judges, and we'll see if they issue a stay. Trump is in Detroit today staging a photo op, promising to repeal a policy that wouldn't actually take effect until 2021. The wrecking crew wants to dismantle one of Obama's achievements, which was to sharply increase the fuel mileage requirements of American manufactured cars. It was supposed to go up to 54.5 miles a gallon by 2025. And the automakers, who never complained really to Obama that I recall, they all wept on the Oval Office desk of Donald Trump. I guess they were in a nearby conference room. Anyway, the plan is to roll this back. But like so many things, Trump is figuring out it's not that simple. And the process requires hearings and comments and all that stuff. And a true rollback of these rules wouldn't take effect until 2021. Which means if we could dump Trump and the Republicans by 2018, you're hearing me daydream here, that we might be able to reverse that before it actually finally kicks in. The Federal Reserve today announced another interest rate hike. And this is indication that the Fed trustees, or whatever they're called, that they believe that the economy is extremely stable. And, of course, this conflicts with the characterization from the Trump monster that he inherited a mess. This is an interesting item because just yesterday I read about a policy that's been proposed in France to place taxes on robots and other forms of automation as a way of leveling the playing field for human labor and trying to reduce the job loss going forward due to robots and automation. And Bill Gates has weighed in on this. He made some comments recently. He said that if you can take the labor that used to do the thing automation replaces, and financially and training-wise and fulfillment-wise, have that person go off and do these other things, then you're net ahead. But you can't just give up that income tax because that's part of how you've been funding that level of human workers. That's a really convoluted statement from Bill Gates. But here in San Francisco, Supervisor Jane Kim is considering introducing a measure. She said, "We're finding that robots have begun to destroy millions of American jobs. The long-predicted era of robots and automation replacing human workers has arrived. We need to ensure that the massive new wealth created by automation is redirected to investing in education and training displaced workers for the jobs of the future." And finally, today, you may have noticed that I never talk about sports on this podcast. I'm not a sports fan. I don't invest any time or energy in a college-level sports. The whole NCAA thing is going on without my involvement right now. And, you know, I pop up during the playoffs for the NBA and also for baseball. But that's the extent of my interest. However, I proudly attended Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. And for 80 years, the Northwestern Wildcats have been denied participation in the men's basketball tournament of the NCAA. And this past Sunday, they finally broke that jinx. I think the Cubs winning the pennant may have greased the way for the Wildcats to make it to the NCAA. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment podcast. When I remember to click the right things, it shows up on YouTube free every day. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until